Master Gardener Tom Ford. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Doug.
And if you have any questions for Tom, 946-0435. Earlier is better than later, of course. And while it's snowing here, I know there's a couple things you wanted to talk about specifically. Anything we have to be concerned about with the amount of snow as far as later in the year? This is good because it helps the water table later, right?
Yeah, snowfall helps the water table. We also probably, it'll help insulate the ground a little bit. So if you did have any bulbs already emerging, it's going to start to protect that foliage a little bit as well. So we just look at that nice thermal blanket there. Should do a lot of wonders as far as for a lot of plant material. The only plant that we may have some concern with may be turf grass, and that's due to snow mold. And we have seen, periodically, we've seen infections of snow mold that after the snow had melted, we had large turf areas that are dead, or at least the crowns are thinned out. So there may be a little bit of lawn work that may need to be done in that early April period, perhaps, if we have some snow mold outbreaks.
I was surprised to hear you say that that it creates a thermal blanket when you've got some of the, if the bulbs are coming up. I haven't seen any on my property, but I'm sure that somebody had them for whatever reason. That won't freeze out the foliage on there?
No, actually the snow is pretty good because basically, as it traps the warm radiation coming from the soil, so it just gives you that thermal blanket. We actually try to mimic, it's kind of ironic, we try to mimic snow cover to overwinter containerized perennials and nurseries in some cases. So instead of putting them in a greenhouse or a cold frame, there are people that use what they call structureless thermal blankets. And what they do is they take a layer of white plastic, a layer of lightweight foam, which is like similar to the foam you would see like electronic equipment gets packaged in some cases,
mm-hmm.
and then another layer of white plastic. And the basic concept is that sunlight penetrating is diffused, so you don't get heat buildup, but yet you will trap some heat, some thermal energy in there, and that foam prevents the fluctuation of temperatures. So it's analogous to a layer of white snow over the perennials, except we're putting that thermal blanket on sometime like in perhaps late November, and we'll take it off probably end of February, first week of March.
Interesting. So when people say, oh, this is going to ruin my garden, not necessarily really, no.
No. The only thing is you will get a few surprises perhaps after the snow melts. There are certain winter annuals that if they have not germinated already, will germinate. And the ones that have germinated already will basically grow, expand, and when the snow melts, you will have a bed of bittercress, perhaps, all over the place. So it's great for weed growth and protecting those weeds as well, too.
Unfortunately. 946-0435, Talk Radio 98.5, WRTA with Master Gardener Tom Ford. You told me before we went on you want to talk about fruit trees in the selection, and you did a post on your Facebook page, which we shared to ours. Explain what you want to discuss on that.
Yeah, right now a lot of people you're getting the various seed catalogs and such out there, and you know there are people out there who also aspire to have like a home orchard or to have a fruit planting. I guess the advantage of having fresh fruit on your property is that you don't typically replant it every year. It's there for you maybe for 25, 30 years or longer, depending on what you do plant. But there are some challenges with fruit because a lot of people have a romanticized idea, because it's like when you get that seed catalog, you get these perfect, beautiful cantaloupes, these perfect, beautiful tomatoes, and there's no reference to insects or diseases. Well, when the catalogs come in with the various fruit trees and fruit plants also represented, you know, they don't show you that the apple's got, you know, holes in it, or there's leaf diseases or insect pests like spotted wing Drosophila or whatever that are out there. So, you know, we do have tend to take on this romanticized view of fruit production, and whereas we can do organic vegetable gardening, even though it's a challenge, it's still relatively much easier to practice than trying to be an organic fruit grower. And if you're going to be an organic fruit grower, the first thing I would tell you is don't plant tree fruit. Probably stay to the small fruit plants, because small fruit, like your blueberries, your blackberries, raspberries, and so forth, probably a little bit easier to raise organically. When you get to tree fruit, you know, it's a much, much more difficult process as far as trying to raise organic tree fruit.
Yes, well, that probably just dashed a few hopes there, because if people think of small fruit, it's like, oh, you mean cherries? Well, yeah, but they grow on a big tree.
That's right. And cherries have a couple of challenges in, we'll say, central Pennsylvania. The first challenge is that probably at least 1 year out of five, we are going to have a late spring frost that's going to take your blossoms out. So, you know, 1 year out of five, you probably will not see a full load of cherries, or you will see a partial crop. The other thing is there's a disease called brown rot, and we do not really have an organic alternative for controlling brown rot in what we call stone fruit trees. And cherries, of course, you know how they're, you know, they get a very smooth skin. So basically, it makes even protected fungicides, when you're using chemicals, it makes them a little hard to adhere to. But in the sense that the fruit is slick, it also means, too, that the fungal spores can basically land, they'll find a nice little crack or crevice, and they can basically reproduce without having anything to check them. And so brown rot often will compromise the number of cherries you sort of receive, and in some cases, the quality of the cherries you receive.
I look at it this way. Half a loaf is better than none, because if you're telling me that one of every 5 years I'm not going to get anything, but the other four I'm going to get, I'm going to look at that as a positive.
Yeah, that's a positive. So, but there are people though that want reliability, and usually if you want reliability in the tree fruits, it's going to be apples. And there are some tricks with apples from the standpoint of varietal selection that may help you if you want to grow organic fruit. There are certain apple cultivars that have good disease resistance. They're not perfect, but one of the apples that we look at is Liberty, and the other one would be Freedom. They are, I guess you could say, were bred in New York State. They show great resistance to powdery mildew and apple scab and cedar apple rust. So even though we get south of the New York line and we pick up a little more humidity in our climate here, they still will typically perform better than buying a yellow delicious apple or a red delicious apple or some other commercial variety that we get in the grocery stores.
We have to take a break here with Master Gardener Tom Ford. Now that you're on to varieties of apples, maybe we can discuss that a little bit here. But if anybody has any other questions about gardening, about dealing with this weather and what that's going to mean for your garden in a specific instance of your yard, feel free to call 946-0435. We'll continue on Talk Radio 98.5 WRTS.
Get on board. 946-0435. Your calls are next on Talk Radio 98.5 WRTA.
Now that we have a new year, how about a new vehicle? Make Trax to Dean Patterson Chevrolet for a 2020 Chevy Trax LT all-wheel drive. Zero down, just $339 a month for 72 months, taxes and tags not included. Or how about a 2021 Equinox LS all-wheel drive? 0% for 72 months plus $2,400 customer cash. Patterson pricing can't be beat. From service to sales, you're our Patterson priority. Head to Dean Patterson Chevrolet, 101 Pleasant Valley Boulevard, Altoona.
Dan Boswell Pipes in Alexandria is firing on all cylinders. That's right, they're back to normal business hours and have all your pipes, cigars, and accessories ready for you to choose from at their location in Alexandria on Route 22 or to ship directly to your door. Open Tuesday, Wednesday, and Fridays 9 to 5, Thursdays till 3, Saturdays till 4, and 24-7 at BoswellPipes.com. They're ready, and always remember, as JM says,
there is nothing like a Boswell pipe.
Youth sports builds character, strength, and a desire to be better. Young boys and girls stepping onto the field or court are eager to do well and should be acknowledged when they do. WRTA is proud to announce the ARC Federal Credit Union Youth Sports Star of the Week. To nominate, just email your child's name, age, and town with his or her accomplishment, big or small, to YSSOW2019@gmail.com or call 943-6112. We'll then announce the winner of the ARC Youth Sports Star throughout the week. Show that young competitor that hard work and their best effort does come with rewards, and watch their excitement when they hear their name announced on WRTA and when they receive their award. Email YSSOW2019@gmail.com or call 943-6112 today. It's the ARC Federal Credit Union Youth Sports Star of the Week.
If it's happening, we're talking about it. Central PA's only station for local talk. Talk Radio 98.5 WRTA.
We're now updated on sports. We got some messages from our sponsors, and I have dry shoes on, unlike the little first segment of the program. Talk Radio 98.5 WRTA. It's the 11th hour. Doug Herendeen and Master Gardener Tom Ford from Penn State Cooperative Extension. And we were talking about apple trees when we got into fruit trees, and you said that they're more of a sure thing than, say, something like a cherry tree. And admittedly, I think more people would probably try to grow an apple tree than a cherry tree. There are more people that are going to do it. The demand is there.
Right. And I think apples, we have a couple other advantages, too, is that we have rootstocks, that, especially dwarfing rootstocks that are out there, that can give us a smaller stature tree, which allows, you know, picking from the ground. It allows you, if you're going to spray, it allows you to spray more readily. And if you have a very small yard, you can imagine if you just have, say, a split rail fence, which maybe tops out at maybe 40 inches, 42 inches or so. Well, when you look at something like a split rail fence, you know, we can train with the right rootstock an apple tree that gets no higher than the top rail of that fence. So when you think about that small yard, you know, you can do that very easily with apples. We do not have really good dwarf peaches. We don't have good dwarf cherries. And usually we don't really have decent dwarf pears either. So when it comes down to it, you know, the apple may be your best tree for that small yard, realistically.
I'm sure a lot of people sit there and think, well, how long does it take me to get an apple? I plant it this year, and I have to wait until, what, next year? And I'm thinking, in a couple cases, depending upon how large the tree is, you're going to be waiting for a while, right?
No, not actually. We can actually, with a dwarfing rootstock, usually what we call by the third leaf, we're getting really good measurable production. So it's a situation you plant it, say, 2021, you will probably get a few apples in 2022, but by 2023, 2024, you know, you're starting to get more apples than, you know, than you just can have for fresh eating. By 2024, by that third leaf, you may have enough production that you can start, you know, to make a few pies, have some fresh eating, and by 2025, probably have the capacity to make your own applesauce.
Well, look at it this way. Those years are going to come and fly by anyway. So if you say, oh, I don't want to wait that long, well, what else you got to do? Put the tree in and enjoy it later.
Right. And the thing is like if you have a fence or something like that, you know, it can help soften the fence. We haven't ever really talked about using espalier techniques, but with espalier, if you go to any of the larger gardens, arboretums, if you go down to anything from the Biltmore to Longwood Gardens and such, you often will see where fruit plants are trained flat along the wall, and in some cases in some very elaborate designs, some of them that may resemble a menorah, some of them may resemble a candelabra, and a lot of variations as far as in that format. But the basic concept is with dwarf apples, you can kind of manipulate them a little bit as long as you have, you know, a good dwarfing rootstock.
I don't know that I've seen that much of that, really. I haven't gotten to Longwood. I'd love to get there someday. But, I mean, as far as training them to different things, I just want apples. So yeah. That's what I'm figuring if I put a tree in.
Well, the dwarfing stocks, what's kind of interesting is that the dwarfing stocks have been around a long time, but what we start to see is that commercial orchards in Pennsylvania are going to what we call higher density plantings. And the idea is that land values are going up, and you have to get a return on your investment much quicker. So what they're doing is twofold. One is they're increasing the density of the orchard, so more trees per acre, okay? Yeah. And then are going, and they're able to do this by going to dwarf stocks. They're planting these trees, some cases as close as 3 foot apart. And they're putting 1,500, 2,500 trees to the acre, some cases even more. So by going to high density orchards, realizing that they can start getting meaningful production by that third leaf, really that third season they plant it, you know, that's the difference between not making a mortgage and making a mortgage.
How do you get the trees to be active at high density versus their natural inclination?
It's really no different. It's just that what they're doing is that they, of course, are providing the nutrients. In some cases, they are providing some supplemental watering.
Yeah.
But if you were to take a drive in Bedford County, is probably the best example, though we do have commercial orchards using some high density here as well. But if you drive along the Chestnut Ridge area, the top of the ridge, and you'd see either Boyer's Orchard or Ridgetop Orchard, you'll see some very high density orchard plantings. And those high density orchards are pretty much the wave of the future as far as for apples go. We can't really do high density peach yet. We can't do high density cherry, but we see these high density apple orchards where, you know, you're getting thousands of bushels per acre, which again allows you to go ahead and, you know, generate pretty decent cash flow.
As long as you can actually get to the trees to harvest them, it's worth
it. Well, if you figure the trees in many cases are not going to be over 6 foot high, okay? Some cases may be more compact than that. So some of them will be on trellises that, you know, they'll be able to pick that orchard without a ladder.
946-0435, Talk Radio, 98.5 WRTA. We have Master Gardener Tom Ford, and Dan in Altoona has a question about trees. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Doug. Now, Tom, you know, you mentioned from one state to the other, you mentioned like with cherries from New York to Pennsylvania. That there, you say there's a difference because the further south you go, the humidity changes and everything. Now, does that affect the tree itself, the humidity, where there's not as much humidity in New York State as there would be in Pennsylvania? Now, does that affect the tree, the health of the tree itself?
Yeah, anytime you move to a more humid environment or you have more rainfall, you will see more disease, okay? And a good example is Douglas fir. I know you deal with spruce trees on your property, but with Douglas fir, we have a lot of residents. I just had someone send me some photographs this past week from Altoona where they have these Douglas firs, so there's hardly any foliage left on them, any needles. And the Douglas fir are susceptible to two diseases, rhabdoquine needle cast and Swiss needle cast. And in our environment, because we have such high humidity and such frequent rainfall, that the Douglas fir will unfortunately become infected, which knocks off the needles and in some cases will eventually kill the tree.
You know,
most definitely weather and humidity does have an impact on tree health.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. Now I checked my trees the other day, and now they were real beautiful. That was the blue spruce was beautiful. Now they're starting to go green. Now, will they come back?
Yeah, if the coloration, because the blue color on a spruce is actually due to a wax on the needle. So over time, that wax may erode a little bit. They may get some erosion of the wax. Also, in some situations, if people were to put a horticultural oil on or a dormant oil to get rid of, say, spider mites or something like that, that also will strip that waxy, we call waxy bloom, off the tree itself. So there are different factors that can cause that bloom to be kind of eroded. some cases even trees stress a little bit. If a tree gets stressed a little bit, like a blue spruce, the first year it's planted, sometimes due to transplant shock, that waxy bloom will disappear. So it's something you want to keep an eye on.
That sticky substance, is that what you're talking about that comes off of like of a pine tree?
No. The sticky stuff is actually rosin. But what actually makes a blue spruce blue is actually a wax on the needle.
On the needle itself, it's just
a natural plant wax.
Okay, all right. And then you mentioned about the Bedford County and the apples. Now, there's a place in Fishertown that at Christmas time I send them to my grandkids, the apples, and the apples from there are 110% better than the apples that they get down in Virginia. And now, why would that be? And then Virginia is a lot more humid, a lot more, I mean, the weather is quite a bit different between there and Bedford County.
Well, when you look at the apples that are produced in Bedford County in that Chestnut Ridge area, they're being produced anywhere between 900 to 1,100, 1,500 feet in elevation. So when you go up in elevation, you get a little bit higher light quality. And with better light quality, you're going to get better coloration of the apple. Okay. Now, there are some things we can do to trick the trees a little bit. Some growers use what we call summer shearing. There's some chemistries that can be used to give better color. But in many cases, light intensity will give you a better colored fruit.
Now, Tom, do you go there? Are you called there in Bedford County and to inspect them things if they have a problem?
Yeah, I work with the orchard growers in Blair County and Bedford County. And in Blair County, we still have Heinisch Orchard. We have Breidenbowl's Orchard. Both Neil and the Breidenbowls probably do more wholesale production today where they're producing it and they're selling it to other people and to other packing houses. So if you were to get an apple perhaps from Giant Eagle or Martin's, it may not say it on the bag in some cases, but if it's an apple produced in Pennsylvania, it very well could be either Breidenbowl's or Heinisch's. Ridgetop and then Boyer's Orchard down there as well, what they do is they will still sell some directly via retail, but a lot of their apples also get packed and are shipped out of the area too. So even Ridgetop at one time was exporting some apples out of the United States. So I'm not sure if they're still doing that, but you know, we have really good apple growers here, and apples are the predominant species we grow because our climate usually is very good, and it's also very dependable from an income standpoint.
Now, the ones that I have shipped and everything, now they tell me there's several different types of apples, but the ones that I get, they're pretty costly. They're not cheap, you know.
Well, but one of the things that we don't realize that with some of the apples today, that we call them club apples, okay? And there are certain apple varieties that a homeowner couldn't buy the tree, okay? There have been apple varieties, I think like Cosmic Crisp, which is one that doesn't leave the West Coast. We can't even buy it to grow it here with a lot of our apple growers. But there are certain varieties that they control the market, the people that I'll see they're hybridized or bought the rights to them. And those apples, for the most part, have to be sold or grown in certain specific areas, only licensed to grow on certain operations. So when you have an apple that has a license like that, okay, then it's a situation that's going to increase the cost back to the consumer.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for your information, as always. You take care. Bye now.
You too, Dan.
Dan, thank you very much. Gary in Duncansville, thanks for waiting. You had a question about cherry trees.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I have a 14-year-old Rainier cherry tree. I've never pruned it. It's a beautiful tree. It's shaped nicely. It gets good cherries, especially every other year. My wife has never wanted me to prune it, but I really can't reach the cherries that are up high, and there's lots of them. I wonder if it's too late to prune the tree or not.
No, in all actuality, we will typically prune it in the month of March. We don't like to prune it early right now So we've got pretty much the end of March to do our pruning. When you head it back, sometimes you'll lose some large wounds, but I realize how big they can get over time. But you may also want to thin it out a little bit, too, as you do some pruning cuts. But month of March is preferable. An older tree like that, you could do anywhere from March 1st to the end of March with no problem.
So, like, how much of the height could I cut off safely?
Well, the rule of thumb with most trees, again, we don't like topping anything, but in the case of an orchard, we kind of do things a little bit differently. If you have to reduce the height, no more than one-third.
Okay.
And correspondingly, again, do some thinning as well, because what it will do is it'll start to fill out, sort of, you know, lower in the profile over time. But ideally, by reducing the height, you just want to try to hopefully translate more bearing in future years to the lower shoots in that respect.
I also have three younger trees. One's a Rainier and two are Montmorency. And they're only 2 years and 3 years old.
Right.
Should I be pruning them now or just let them grow a little bit longer before I do anything?
I would probably do some selective pruning on them. Try to thin them out a little bit. The Montmorency will be more compact than the Rainier will. The Rainier is just going to try to go as large as the other one did. So,
yeah.
But the Montmorency, a lot of times, you know, growth rate on them, you know, probably half the growth rate of the Rainier. May finish out 15 to 18 feet in height. So this should be a lot easier to work with that, those two.
Now, my tree, the mature one, is about 15 feet high. Is that a normal height?
Or? They can grow up to about 25 feet.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
The Morenci is going to always should be about half the size of Rainier once it's mature. But, yeah, you definitely can bring that Rainier down, but no more than a third at a time.
Okay.
Gary,
thanks for your help.
Gary, before you go, I have a question. Your wife said she was concerned about you trimming the tree. Was it that she didn't want to injure the tree or that she likes the way it looks now?
Yeah, she likes the way it looks now. It's a pretty tree. It's one of the trees that I planted in my yard that survived. Many of them have not. Mm. And it was a bare root tree when we planted it, and it's very nice. But I can't get the cherries. The birds get most of them anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm still haven't given up hope on getting the cherries. I love those cherries.
Yeah.
They're good eating cherries, yes.
See, I'm just wondering, I mean, if half the appeal of the tree, I mean, obviously you love the cherries, that's great, but if half the appeal is the ornamental value, Tom, what do you think?
Yeah,
well,
once you cut it back, it'll change its appearance a good bit.
What's that, Tom?
It will change its appearance a good bit once you do cut it back like that, because the tendency is it's still going to try to get taller, so it's going to produce lots of growth there around those wounds, and so you cut it back, it may send up 3 to 4 foot shoots off the top.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I planted it to eat the fruit.
Yeah,
right.
It may just do me to doing a lot of pruning every year once you do prune it.
Okay. All righty, I'll have to give it some thought. Thank you.
All right, Gary, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Best of luck deciding what to do and how to do it there. 946-0435, Talk Radio 98.5 WRTA from Penn State Cooperative Extension. We have Master Gardener Tom Ford. How long? Now, he said the one Rainier cherry he has is about 14 years old. The others are kind of young. How long will that particular type of tree last, say, versus an apple tree?
In both cases, you know, they can be very long-lived. An apple tree with no disease pressure on a good site could be productive for 50 years or longer, okay? Cherries usually about 20 to 25 years, and that's because typically either disease issues or due to, you know, climatic issues. Like, cherries don't like wet feet, okay? So it's a situation. And we go through several dry years in a row, the tendency is the roots tend to go deeper into the soil profile. And then if we get a real wet year like we had 2 years ago and the water table comes up, those roots that are deeper in the profile basically start to suffer because of the lack of oxygen, and we start to see root rot occur. So So we've seen orchards where cherry trees have done very, very well, 15, 20 years, no problems. We go through some very drier conditions, no problem. And then when we get this heavy rainfall year, we start to see trees start to die out in the orchard. And so that's one issue. There's one insect that can also cause short life, and that is the peach tree borer. Even though we think cherries and peaches, well, what's the issue here? But peach tree borer is a clear wing moth that will lay eggs on stone fruit trees. So peach, cherry, plum, nectarine, apricot. And the larvae is actually a caterpillar that will bore into the trunk. It'll feed under the bark and cause a girdling of the tree and will cause the tree to die.
Ish.
And so, you know, peach tree borer issues, Gary's lucky that he has not seen them, because usually about that 12 to 15 year age range is when you start to see peach tree borer start to hit, you know, established cherries, same thing with plums. And usually the symptom we look for is we call it gummosis. We see the amber-colored sap kind of leaking out and globs on the trunk. Well, the sap of a cherry or a peach tree or apricot, nectarine, whatever, is clear. That's what the natural color of the sap looks like. So if the sap is just clear, that's just normal gummosis. But if it turns an amber-colored, that tells us you have frass that's mixed in with it. Of course, frass is the excrement from the insect. Mm. So it's a combination of the frass with the clear sap that gives it that amber coloration. So we see amber globs of sap on the tree. That tells us that we have a peach tree borer infestation. And one of the problems we have is that the insecticides we use to control peach tree borer have to be put on before the borers get inside. They can't be used after the infestation. So it also makes it very problematic from a control standpoint, is how do you control something that's already in a tree?
Yeah. That would drive me nuts, because I would finally notice something and then think, oh, wait a minute, we've got to do something, it's not necessarily going to work.
Right. And so chemicals won't work, but there is actually a biological alternative that you can use to kill peach tree borer. We can do the same thing for dogwood borer as well. Dogwood borer is another one of these clear wing moths. And even though we think of dogwood borer attacking dogwoods, dogwood borer also attacks apple trees. So even though they're two different, you know, families per se, you know, dogwood borer is a clear wing moth, goes to apples as well. But in both cases, we have a biological alternative. It's basically called, it's a mouthful, it's an entomopathogenic nematode.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. So we know there are nematodes that are plant parasitic. Well, these are nematodes that actually will seek out and kill other insects. And so what you can actually do is buy the nematodes. They'll get shipped to you from a specialty lab in like a little envelope. You basically will mix them in water, usually like still water initially, and even though they're shipped to you as a dry powder, if they're, you know, alive, what will happen is once they get in the water, they kind of like reanimate, and then you just put it in your sprayer. In the evening, you spray your bark with this nematode water mixture and then wrap the lower trunk with some damp burlap so it just keeps them moist until they can find their host or their prey. And what they do is they find the small channels in the bark. They find the caterpillar there that's bored into the tree, and they kill it.
Interesting how that works.
Yeah, they're nature's heat-seeking missile.
And it's just a natural reaction. They know what to do.
They know what to do, and what's kind of interesting is that they have a bacteria in their gut that they transmit to that caterpillar, okay? And then that bacteria is actually what helps kill that caterpillar. And it kind of liquefies the insides of the caterpillar. And then they get to feed off of what, I guess you say, liquefies. And they will produce a couple of generations in there. And then eventually that insect will rupture, the cadaver will, and it releases the nematodes back out of the environment.
Huh.
The problem is we have to keep buying them. That's something that
it's not a perpetual colony.
Right. They won't establish a colony, but we can use nematodes like that for borers, And yet we can also use these beneficial nematodes. If you go to Canada, they don't allow lawn chemicals to kill Japanese beetle grubs in the turf. What they allow you to do is to buy the beneficial nematodes and apply them to your turf to kill the white grubs in your lawn.
Are they very expensive?
Not really. I was looking at it for another purpose. I think about if you were to look on an acre of ground, the cost of it $170, I think, an acre, roughly. So when you think about what your chemical costs are, and if you're worried about, you know, kids and pets and, you know, groundwater contamination, whatever your thought process is as far as chemicals go, okay, it gives you, it's just another alternative.
Yeah.
So if somebody wants to be completely bio-based with their turf care, okay, and again, there's sometimes where they are very effective and sometimes they may be less effective because if they don't survive, then they're not going to kill the insects in the turf. So chemistries are probably more dependable and you know, we can guarantee 94% effectiveness, but this is an alternative to using chemistries for certain insects.
Although when you described it at the beginning, I'm thinking it sounds strangely like sea monkeys or something, but that's another story. With Master Gardener Tom Ford, and if you don't remember sea monkeys, well, you weren't looking at the back of the right comic books, what can I say? 946-0435, we have Hannah and Altoona. We'll get to your call next on the 11th hour.
The opinions you hear on WRTA are the hosts, callers, and guests, and are not necessarily those of the station, its management, or advertisers.
Attention Blair and surrounding counties. It's the spectacular stimulus sale going on now at J&P Auto Mart. Get $1,250 for your trade-in. Need financing? Apply online at jnpautomart.com. It's the spectacular stimulus sale at J&P Auto Mart, 1906 Pleasant Valley Boulevard, Altoona.
The highest efficiency dishwasher can't guarantee spot-free glasses if you have hard water. But with a Culligan high-efficiency water softener, even your regular dishwasher keeps glasses spot-free. Better yet, it virtually ends hard water spotting throughout your entire home, from your glasses to your shower doors. Plus, it saves up to 46% on water, salt, and energy. Culligan, better water, pure and simple.
Hey, Culligan man!
1801 Pleasant Valley Boulevard, Altoona. Call 944-2091.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. My training helps me at work when I lead by example. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my community and those I care about safe from threats. Learn more about how you, too, can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. Aired by the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Leading the way in local talk once again. Central PA's first FM talk station. Talk Radio 98.5 WRTA.
Reminder, tomorrow we have David Ickes in your calls. On Wednesday, Arts Altoona with Donna Gordy and guest Comedy Realty Group Limited Money Talks on Thursday, and the return of Dial and Deal on Friday. Buy, sell, trade, give stuff away. Look for stuff you'd like to buy. You can email Doug at lightnerradio.com with whatever you have that you're selling. Photos help a great deal, and we can put them up on the brand-new website, which we're debuting piece by piece and adding more stuff every single day. So we'll start using that for Dial and Deal this coming Friday. But we already have the closings, delays, and cancellations on there, so you can check those out. With Master Gardener Tom Ford, we have Hannah in Altoona has a couple different plants she wanted to ask about here, I believe. Hannah, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I have two plants that I'm talking about, one indoor, one outdoor. I have a burning bush that's been established for a couple of years. It has never turned red. Why?
If for some reason the burning bush is overstimulated with too much nitrogen, okay, they will not provide you good fall color, okay? I had some in my own yard, and then I had used a slow-release fertilizer around them, and because they were having the higher nitrogen content, they would go pretty much from green to drop, okay? May get a little tinge of purple, but nothing to it. I have not put any fertilizer on them in the last probably 10 years now. They color up really in red every year. So if for some reason, if the soils are too nutrient-rich, then that could be why they're not developing the red color.
So I live in a mostly wooded area.
Okay.
And we have dead leaves blowing around all the time. Does that increase the nitrogen?
It could, because of the compost nature of it. That would be the only thing there. Is there any septics or sand mounds or anything near there?
No, at least 200 feet or more.
Okay, because I would say it would have to be like a nutrient issue to stop the coloration. Sometimes if they're real shaded, they may not develop as good of color either. If they were densely shaded, but usually it's a fertility issue where they're getting too much nutrients. Now,
can I do anything?
Yeah, what I would try is to get a little bit of superphosphate. Okay. How many do you have? Just like one bush or?
Just one.
Okay. Try to get treble superphosphate. They'll have it. Garden Center's like in a 5-pound bag. Okay. And you don't need much. You're only going to need about on one plant, maybe about a cup. Okay. And all you're going to do is broadcast that lightly underneath the burning bush euonymus. Okay. And what the phosphorus will do is, sometimes it'll give you a little bit better coloration. So maybe try that. It also may sort of counteract if you're getting a little excess nitrogen, a little excess fertility as well.
What did you say to get?
Superphosphate.
Okay. Now, I have a hydrangea bush that's not probably less than 20, I would guess maybe 10 feet away.
Okay.
Will that affect that?
No. Unless you're trying to look at it from a color standpoint, would you mind what color the hydrangea is?
I'd like it to be purple or blue.
Okay. Let me check real quick on that. Do you do any type of fertility with that at all?
I always have to write it down because one is, and if you increase the acidity,
right?
I think it's increase turns blue, isn't it?
I always get them confused myself. It's one of these things I deal with this all the time, but I'm going to have to check real quick because we actually one is to adding additional phosphorus too.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so we look at acidity and alkalinity. So let me just go real quick.
I'm amazed when I've seen the same type of plant in one town and it's one color. You go to a different town because there's different soil and it's another.
Oh, I think that's so neat.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what it is that makes it, turns it from blue to purple or pink to white either. I assume it's the amount of acidity, but that's just on my part.
Typically for pH, the higher the alkalinity, the higher the pH, typically the more pink, they go blue typically. We would have to increase the acidity. I believe also phosphorus is a factor as well, but that would be the biggest thing is it's just the pH management, but phosphorus does have a role with that as well. May have to find the reference.
If you increase the acidity, it turns
right to go blue.
Okay.
I remember we talked about this a long time ago.
Yeah, I had actually a whole, I do an hour presentation on it. It's one of these things that's sort of out of sight, out of mind, and you don't deal with something for a while. But there is a whole protocol. Let me get my protocol real quick with that.
I'll tell you, Tom, if it's in the interest of time, if you want to send me the information, I can put it or put it on your Facebook. I'll share it onto ours for later.
Okay.
I'm amazed that you can remember all the things that you do remember. So this is no big deal.
That's why he's here. You had a question about another type of plant as well?
Yes. I had a new spider plant that I bought this summer. I kept it out on the porch, and oh, my God. It is the most spectacular spider plant I ever had. Spiders everywhere. It's great. brought it in the house, and I'm just struggling to keep it alive now. I might only have maybe 10, 12 spiders, where before it was just loaded. What am I doing wrong?
Okay, are you seeing any brown tips at all in the plant?
Yes.
Okay. When it was outdoors, were you using the same water source?
Yes.
Okay. When you watered it outdoors, were you using, first of all, do you have a water softener?
Yes.
Okay. When you were watering it outdoors, were you watering it from the outside faucet or from water from inside the house?
The outside faucet.
Okay. So if you have a water softener, the indoor faucets are connected to the water softener. The outdoor faucet usually isn't or shouldn't be. So it may be due to the softened water. Okay. The brown tips will tell us there's some root injury. And if they appear to be stressed, if the salt from the water softener, that is whether it's exchanged sodium salt or your calcium magnesium salt, and then as the sodium level increases, that's going to stress that spider plant out. It's going to give you your brown tips. So very well, okay, if you change your water source, just either use the outside faucet water to water the spider plant, or get a jug of still water, spring water,
Hannah,
whatever.
Tom, we're out of time. I'll let you talk here off the air in a second, but thanks very much.